Hello and welcome to the 56th episode of the First Take Film Club podcast. I am your host, Liam Jones, and today, for the first time ever, it is a bonfire night special, which is going to be aired on the 6th of November, strangely enough, because our scheduling is awful. As ever, I am joined by my lovely co-host, Connor Norcott. Luke Chanley, he can't be here today because he is super duper busy with all of his work. Because he's just a busy boy. Connor, how are you, my friend?
I'm good. You know, I'm really hungry. This is the day after the first day of lockdown 2.0, and I was in work today, kind of closing the place down. Earlier before that, I was watching the film that we're going to talk about later, and I've not eaten yet. So I've got some soup in the kitchen that I can kind of smell coming through my really thin walls in this flat. And awesome. I'm not saying this, you know, this is over the better, but you know. I'm going to start giving you speed, like quick up hand signals.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. That's fine. I was saying to you off air, Connor, that I'm actually in a really good mood, but I've had a nightmarish day, to be honest. My morning started off with me realizing that I'd lost my bank card. I've never lost a bank card ever. So that was fun. Luckily, you know, online banking these days, I sorted it out in like 30 seconds. It was great. But then, as I was writing notes on this film, the pen kind of exploded and went all over my brand new Manchester United shirt. Serves me right for wearing a Manchester United shirt at the minute, because I don't know if any listeners know, but they're awful. And then, literally about an hour ago, as we're recording at 8 p.m, I dropped my phone down the toilet. I won't go into details. All I'll say is... it's okay now. Anti-back and hand soap and some kitchen roll, and we're all good. So there are a lot of bad things that happened, but then they were kind of saved, although the pen is still on the shirt. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe like the world is telling me to not wear Man United shirts like for the next, I don't know, couple of years, I guess. Just until like they start playing better football. But I digress. This is not a football podcast. This is a film podcast. And today, as I said before, this is a bonfire night special. And to be honest, the only bonfire night film I could think of that actually is about exactly that is V for Vendetta. And yeah, we will talk about that later. I just want a quick word from Connor about how excited are you to do this film, man?
Oh, man. Is it a first take for you as well?
It's not a first take. It's more like I'll call it a refresh take, because I've not seen it for about 10 or 12 years.
So, this is a first take for me, and I've been wanting to watch this forever, and I don't know why I haven't done it. It always looked like one of those films that was like most people I talk to really like this film, but it always seemed a little bit. It's always been low down on the pecking order for me.
You're a big Natalie Portman fan as well, so
I think she's awesome. Yeah, I just watched Jackie the other day. She's in that. Oh my god!
Oh yeah,
she actually might be one of the best actors ever. I should say, honestly, she just fucking rocks, man.
Really, 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 really dislike her English accent in this, so it's really bad.
I gotta agree with you on this. Like we said, I'm super excited for this film, and we're gonna talk about a lot of the good things.
But yeah, we will.
I've got two bad things that I've written down in my notes, and one of them is her accent. Bless her.
Yeah, I like underlined the words Natalie Portman accent awful. but her acting is really good. There is we'll obviously go into more detail later, but there's one moment where it's kind of like awe inspiring, really. But first of all, usually we like to open up with a nice little question. This is a bit of a niche one, but it is is very much related to Bonfire Night. And it came when I was thinking earlier about firework displays or fireworks in movies or even pyrotechnics, like interesting pyrotechnics in movies. And what came to mind is a film that we've actually done on the podcast before, which is Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. And it's obviously near the beginning of the film in, you know, the Baggins land. What's it called?
Hobbiton,
there we go, thank you. And Gandalf has, does he have them? Merry and I really am absolutely butchering my explanation of this. Merry and Pippin set off this absolutely ginormous dragon firework, and it swoops down. It actually used to petrify me watching it when I was a kid, but it's just so kind of magical almost. Oh, another one just came to mind in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix when Fred and George set off the fireworks.
That's such a good one.
I know, when they when they're disrupting Dolores Umbridge's weird, like, Hitler-esque reign on Hogwarts. Yeah, mate, when you think about it, there are a few. Well, I've thought of two firework ones. I know you've got an interest in, like, pyrotechnic-y one.
Yeah, I
that's a word.
I couldn't think of, like, off the top of my head. I think you asked this in our group chat maybe about 2 hours ago, and I thought, we'll think of something better than that. We didn't. So yeah, once this was kind of sprung on me last minute, I kind of thought the first thing that came to my mind was one of the opening car chase sequences in Fury Road, Mad Max Fury Road. And there's a scene with the, they have that mad truck with, like, the guy with the guitar. And when he plays the guitar, the flames come out. And
yeah, that's awesome.
They're shooting fireworks off other trucks and they kind of pop in these big explosions of color. And it kind of, I don't know, it kind of echoes the bits in Apocalypse Now when they're going up the river and they have those little kind of, I don't know, color fireworks that pop out. Those two are my favorite scenes, I think, because they are, I don't know, they're so, like, heavy, hell-like environments, and they've got these little flashes of color, and it's quite, quite pleasing to the eye.
This is one that you're going to love me for saying, and it's the opening to Blade Runner with the fire coming out of the like the buildings as it's kind of panning across the skyline. That is just, because how they did it as well, because I'm pretty sure that they did not shoot it. They used, like, miniatures, didn't they?
They used miniatures, yeah. Yeah,
so to get, so to be able to get that, I don't know if someone was standing behind with a lighter, like, trying to get... just trying to get the flame behind it. But however they did it, it's brilliant. It's absolutely amazing. It really, like, is. that opening scene with the music and everything, it's just superb. I can't think of anything else, to be honest. I mean, I was clutching at straws with the question in itself, to be honest.
I agree.
And now I'm here trying to think, what else can I think of? I personally think my two examples were spot on. And I liked yours as well. Just it wasn't as good as mine. Anyway, let's move on. Do we have any other business you would like to discuss before we get on to V for Vendetta?
I don't think so. I think I just want to talk about this film.
Amazing. Can't wait. Let's get into it then. So, who decided this film for us? I think it was Luke last week. I think he...
I think we were just... We might have been talking about Bonfire Night kind of... anyway, and then he was like, oh yeah, I can't wait to watch V for Vendetta, and I was like, oh, I've never saw that, and we were like, oh, and we have to do this film, and I was like, all right, sign. Like I said, I've been waiting for a reason to watch it. There's a couple of other films that are a bit like that, but I don't want to give them off now in case they also get bumped up the queue and replace what's coming next week. But yeah, I've honestly been dying to watch this film forever, and I didn't realize it was so like 1984 inspired. It's almost just an adaptation of that as much as it is an adaptation of the comic book that it's based on as well.
So before we get chatting about the film, I'll just give a quick synopsis. Basically, the film is set in a future Britain under the tyrannical reign of a government party called Norsefire. They're kind of like weird, almost like Nazi-ish type characters. It is very tyrannical, very alt-right, very angry in your face, violence. Basically they have a lot of, well, it's one of those things, isn't it, where it's their regimes are all kind of so extreme and shocking. You know, they're kind of like, they're anti-LGBT, aren't they? They're kind of anti this, anti that, and they're basically all about wiping out, probably, well, in their minds, probably wiping out all of the lower, poorer classes, and, you know, trying for some reason or another to have this one kind of one race and one class to kind of rule over Britain. So that is kind of the government rule. And then there is this freedom fighter who just goes by the alias of V, who is kind of the main character. He's I would say he was the protagonist. And he's also helped, I guess, in a way by Natalie Portman's character, Evie. And basically that is it in terms of the synopsis. It's a vigilante almost trying to overrule a tyrannical government. And to be honest, that is actually a really interesting premise in itself, especially when you throw into the fact that it's, you know, originally a DC comic. So there's obviously some, it's not supernatural, but it's, there is a hero element to it, mm-hmm. and almost like an origin element to the character, which mm-hmm. I can already tell by your face that you're not 100% sold on that bit. Mm-hmm. To be honest, there are parts of this film anyway where the comic book element maybe takes me away from it a little bit. I might have preferred maybe more of a straightforward kind of take on this film, because it's written by the Wachowskis, obviously very well known for directing and writing The Matrix, which is, you know, one of the most popular, well, the first film is one of the most popular sci-fi films of all time. So they've got previous. Their writing is pretty good, to be fair. And I know even with films such as Cloud Atlas, they have, you know, a really big following. You know, their writing is quite often complex, but obviously this time it is an adaptation from a DC graphic novel. I just want to know, Connor, this was your first take. So what was your first take, basically, as soon as the film finished?
I almost wanted to watch it again. I know that sounds really stupid, but I watched it just before I went to work, and I knew I had to go to work, and I think I had about 5 minutes of downtime between that, and I was just toying with even going on YouTube and just picking a couple scenes to watch again, because it's a really entertaining movie. Like, I didn't think it would be as fun as it is. I thought it would be kind of, especially nowadays, we live in a very twilight times or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
From Chris. Yeah.
Yeah.
We live in a really strange time at the minute where a lot of art is very applicable and very relatable to the moment we're in now. And I thought this would be really heavy and kind of a bit more of a film I would normally suggest on this podcast, yeah. and not something Luke would. And now it makes total sense that he would suggest it, because yeah, it might have those little undertones, but it's fun. It's a fun movie.
It's really playful. Mm-hmm. It's really playful. And I think that is one of the things that at times I would rather it not be. I think it does. I think the premise, to be honest, doesn't lend itself to that. I think, you know, the actual bare bones of the plot don't lend itself to, you know, some elements of the film, which actually in truth are quite jovial. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I didn't really like is the score, because I think at times it kind of becomes too playful. I'm almost to a point where I was like, you probably could have done with something different here, just to give a different feeling at times, because obviously it's a 15. So, you know, they could have really lent into the darkness, as it were. And, you know, it is a really kind of dark and twisted premise with this tyrannical government who are doing awful things. You know, they're alleged to have man-made biological warfare, chemical warfare, even terrorism, you know, with bombing undergrounds and stuff like that, starting civil wars between obviously like the civilians of Great Britain. So like the premise is dark, and to the point where actually, you know, it is doused a little bit in realism, in the fact that, you know, things like this do happen in the world. So it's not something that is, you know, completely far-fetched to the point where you have to be so playful with it, in my opinion. However, there are obviously elements, I think, because V is such a... He is a character, isn't he?
He is very flamboyant, I would say. Yeah.
But I think that's where they get it spot on. And that is where the playfulness comes from. You know, he's a guy, you never see his face. He's always wearing a mask, you know, a Guy Fawkes mask with, you know, this really neat black wig, a big kind of like musketeer-esque hat, this black coat. He's got these real shiny, sharp, extravagant knives that he uses to throw at his enemies. And him, he is flamboyant and he is kind of out there, and the way he talks, I think I wrote down kind of the way we're introduced to him. Obviously, we are introduced to both V and EV almost immediately in the film, with kind of a, it was like a switching shot, I don't know what you'd call it, between him looking in the mirror and her looking in the mirror. And that's great kind shot. Of the, yeah, it is a really great shot. And that's kind of the introduction to the two characters. But moments later, pretty much, Evie's confronted in the streets by these goons who kind of work for the government. They're basically put out there just to antagonize people in the streets. And then along comes V moments later to save the day. And he's there, he's essentially just talking absolute nonsense. But then within about 5 minutes, yeah, he's talking nonsense, but you understand almost his motives. You understand kind of what type of person he is. You understand mm-hmm. what type of person Evie is, mm-hmm. all within the space of the first 5 minutes. And now you're two main characters. And that for me is kind of really great writing from the Wachowskis. That's something that I really liked about it. I was going to ask you kind of what did you like really about the opening?
The opening, I'm a sucker for like the getting ready scenes. You know what I mean? Like the people yeah. putting on, whether it's like the scene from I, Tonya where she's putting on her makeup and it's kind of like war paint, or it's a bit more chilled. Like in this, you kind of get the two extreme sides. He's putting on his costume when he's ready to not fight crime, but let's say met crime and do some crimes. And she's kind of getting ready for, I think she's maybe going to see her friends, played by Stephen Fry, a guy called Dietrich, who honestly loves Stephen Fry. Not in this. I'm sorry, Stephen, mate.
Oh, I liked him. I like Stephen Fry in everything he's in, to be honest. I think he's great.
He is great, but I just thought there's a couple, you know, when you're hiding bad acting, they cut to reaction shots of the character. Right. They didn't do that enough for me. Like, there's some yeah. scenes where there's close-ups of him, and I'm like, oh, bless Stephen. This, you know, this one came a bit too early for him, in my humble opinion, anyway.
Oh, See, I thought there was bad acting in this film, but I don't think it came from him. I think it came from, I don't actually know his name. I think, not the chief detective, but his assistant. The guy from Luther. Is he in Luther? Is he in Sherlock?
Oh, no, sorry. Well? He is. He's in.
He's in Sherlock.
He's in Sherlock. You're right. No, he's Sherlock. Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, talk too badly about him, because he's actually, I feel like now, in Sherlock, he is really good. But I don't know if this maybe was quite early in his career, but some of the lines he delivers, it's a little bit wooden and a little bit like robotic. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Like, it's
especially the scene where the main inspector, who I can only remember the name of the actor, Stephen Ray, he's on the phone.
Is his name like Finney or something?
Yeah, something like that. He's on the phone to the guy you're talking about, and you can just hear it so dead. It's clearly they weren't recorded at the same time, but they played the sounds over it in the edit, and it just doesn't match up. But no. Anyway, there are some little moments where I think this film is actually really kind of clumsy at times, but I'm not asked at all. Like, I was fully bought into it. I didn't know how it ended. I knew some key scenes. I knew the kind of, you know, V's big kind of climactic fight scene near the end that we'll get on and talk about. But I didn't know how they all played out. I didn't know how they played out in context. And watching it all unfold and in relation to like the structure of the film, and actually watching, I don't know, I cared about V and Evie from the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
The only thing I didn't like, and maybe it's because I was really stupid, is I didn't understand his introduction, where he goes on and lists who he is. He's like a vivacious vagabond with a fucking pair of knives or something. I don't know what he says, but every other word begins with the letter V, and I forgot his name was V, and the film was called V for Vendetta. So I was kind of like, what the fuck's this guy on about?
He says in Lieu a lot. In Lieu.
Yeah, he does. Yes, he does. And I've only ever seen that written in emails, and
I know
I'm not into it.
He says it honestly in that opening kind of monologue that he gives. He says it about five times, and he says it later on again. It's like, use some different words, bro. Like, you're a clever guy, clearly. Use some different
he
words.
Definitely is, yeah.
It's interesting, because I was reading up on the character from the comic books, and in the comic books, there is literally barely an origin to him at all. I think there is, obviously, I think there is a story about him being burnt in a fire, and the experiments that they had on him basically wiped his memory out entirely.
Yeah.
Which is why he's basically anonymous, which is another thing I was going to talk about later. There's a lot of things in within this film that have sparked almost, you know, kind of these groups of what would you call them, like hackers almost.
Yeah, well,
like
Anonymous is a hacktivist group, but then they think this was also an inspiration. Like, this was a film that I remember it being referenced during the riots in Egypt a year or two ago now.
Yeah.
And it was the most referenced piece of art in like 2017. And even though the comic came out before 2006, the film came out in 2006, there is kind of a longevity here. And it buys into that idea that like, the concept that an idea is impervious. It's going to live forever.
Yeah. And I think as well, like when you're playing on something like the saying is remember the 5th of November. It's never been forgotten, and it was 415 years ago or something like that. It was, you know, I think it was 1604. Maybe my maths is wrong. I don't know. I'm sure it was 1604 that Guy Fawkes attempted to blow up the Houses of Parliament. And this kind of, it opens with, a reenactment of that happening. And it kind of is there throughout in the background. That is what fuels V. This is what, he almost sees this as, a thing that was meant to happen. Mm-hmm. It's something that needs to happen to fuel this change, because what's happening right now is, you know, it's rotten from the core. The government's rotten from the core. And, you know, it's obviously we speak about things that are timely. Like, this came out in 2005 when I think we were as in the UK and Northern Ireland were run by Labour. So I don't really know what it was like then, because I was 8 years old, but watching it now, you know, with the Tories involved in the country, I don't want to get too political, but it was just very, very, eye-opening to see, like, obviously this film is taking everything to the absolute extremes of what, you know, it's all about. There are countries in the world that are like this, with kind of like total surveillance on everyone, and the media is controlled completely by the government. And it's all about the rich, you know, feeding the rich and making the rich richer and basically imprisoning the poor. And that's kind of what they took here and made it in the UK, which I think is like interesting, because obviously it's set, I think it's set in 2038 or something like that. So it's a few years into our future. But they were obviously looking into it like 30 years ahead when it came out in 2005.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm just getting ahead of myself here, if it's something that they were actually thinking this could happen, or maybe they're inspired by loads. Why I'm so surprised, I've just been rambling on about this, is because they decided to set this in the UK, and I just think it's a weird country.
I
to
love
set
that they've
like
done
this.
Yeah. I love that they've done this, because the film, like, well, sorry, I've never read the graphic novel or the comic that it's based on. I'm really tempted to now, because I've heard great things about Alan Moore. Well, great things about his writing, less about him as an interviewee. Apparently he's a bit curmudgeonly. No harm to you, Alan, if you're right there, pal. Anyway, right, I love that they've done this, because it establishes in the film that there is clearly an issue ongoing in America, and there was a war America was involved in, and then quickly the UK became involved in it, and that's where these kind of self-serving, rich political party centric people kind of all, I don't know, they all kind of, it all kind of became a gross incestuous fucking ladder that they all climbed up, and they stayed together. And that's why V has his little hit list in this film of people that have wronged him, and by wronging him also wronged the people that, like, of the UK. And you never really see films like this in the UK. I think the closest thing that I can relate this film to is Brazil, and they're totally different. Tonally totally different. I said to you off air, this feels almost like a Black Mirror episode that was made 15 years or maybe 10 years too early. And you can kind of tell, like, it is a little bit rough around the edges, but the idea, once again, the idea and the concept is what keeps you going in this.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, like you said, we're not going to get too political and I'm not going to talk about that, but you can clearly tell that this film was made to provoke a conversation at least. And I really enjoy that, because there's enough blasé nonsense garbage that most people watch on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, if you've got 2 hours to spare, you could do a lot worse than watching a film like this.
Yeah.
And having some thoughts of your own, that's how I would put it.
Mm. I think it, in terms of obviously the setting, it obviously it has to be set in the UK because it's about Guy Fawkes and it's about a reenactment of that. So you can't set it anywhere else. So I think that is obviously something that, you know, the Wachowskis, and I think the novels set in London as well. So it's obviously something that they had in mind, because you can't really change that. You know, that's something that is almost set in stone. It would have to be. I just think some of the kind of things that it's almost like, it's shocking because it's so almost real in a way now. I don't know, when I first watched this film, I was probably way too young to kind of even contemplate the fact that like things like this could happen. Obviously, you've got, you know, in the film, they manufacture like a flu. I'm not in no way suggesting that coronavirus is manufactured. That's not what I'm saying. Obviously, in the film, they manufactured a flu, and then the rich people then created a drug, which they then became millionaires off of, because then they created a drug that would eradicate that flu that they created in the first place. It's just...
Isn't it mad, though, that this film's set in the late 2020s, apparently. And if you look at 2020 now, there are quite a lot of parallels into the, you know, the state of things then, the state of things now, with the surveillance, with the one of my favorite scenes, one of my favorite performances is the guy who plays the voice of London, and I wish I could remember his name. I just remember he's one of the guys from The Thick of It. He plays the leader of the Labour Party in The Thick of It, and he's hilarious in that. He is kind of like this. He's almost like a news anchor, and he gives these voiceovers almost like in a Alex Jones way, where he talks about the state of things and what is it, Britain will persevere or something like that. He has this kind of mad catchphrase, and it's so kind of arm hair sticky yuppy fucking cringy and awful because it's happening now. And you know,
no, I know
they have in this film, it kind of structures around V, and V's kind of his idea and his way about dealing with this. It's like you said, cranked up to 11. He's very violent centric, and I'm not saying we should be, but
no, I know exactly that was one of the things. It's it definitely brings in that whole sense of morality, you know, what is right and what is wrong. Is he a hero, or is he almost a villain, or is he, you know, is he someone that you should root for? It's difficult because he's, you know, the character's killing people, but then Evie, who is someone who you'd probably look more as the hero, kind of by the end of the film has total support of this guy. So it's one of those conflicting things, isn't it? And then not to mention, we will get onto the final kind of sequence, the final scene, thousands of people out in support. And for V and what he's, you know, said he's about to do, and what he's set out to do since he, you know, was almost burnt alive in that hospital, or the mental whatever it was that he was,
St. Mary's
Hospital, St. Mary's Hospital, so one of the first kind of big things that happens, and again it's within like the first 15 minutes of the film, you kind of learn straight away that V is not messing around. He 5 minutes later, after he meets Evie, takes her up onto the top of this building, and he says, do you know what time it is? No, do you know what the date is? Oh, it's the 4th of November. And then the chimes, Big Ben starts ringing to say it's midnight. And as soon as that happens, as music starts playing on these big speakers, and then next minute, the Old Bailey just, you know, explodes. And, you know, that's him. He's kind of putting his early statement in, saying, you know, this is me. I'm here to kind of disrupt the government. I've done this year, but next year I'm going to blow up the Parliament, the Houses of Parliament, which is, it's just so crazy. It's just such a crazy kind of could you imagine if that was real,
man? We've got a month and a bit left of 2020, and I don't want to imagine that. As much as I've got my own political leanings, you know, I don't want any more madness, please. Nothing like that, please.
No.
I love that scene though, because something I love, just sorry to cut you off, something I love about this film, it's got moments of subtlety, but most of it is very on the nose. Yeah. And symbols are really heavy in this. So if you understand the symbols, you understand the meaning. And him kind of blowing up the Old Bailey, he almost kind of, just before that, he recites almost like a monologue to the figure on top of the Old Bailey, who's meant to be like a symbol for justice. And by blowing that up, he's saying, well, the justice system is incorrect. Just like the parliament that he's talking about.
Mm.
You've got to remove the system in place to build a new one. And immediately he goes for justice and says, we're going for the government next time round. And I kind of like that. You know what I mean? Like you said, it establishes who he is and what he's about instantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except for that weird little 2-minute monologue about all the V words and how good he is. That was kind of a bit strange, but yeah.
I think what is interesting is it does bring in things that are very, very real, you know, in actual like Western civilization, which is the kind of manipulation of the media. What's quite interesting is at one point, one of the producers kind of behind the screen of like the news anchor on telly goes, our job is to report the news, not to fabricate it. And he says that just as a news anchor is telling a lie about the explosion of the Old Bailey, they basically say it was and you know, that's just interesting itself. You think of Fox News, you think of even, you know, at times the BBC can maybe be leaning a little bit to the right when it comes to election time. You know, that's just my assumption anyway. I'm not saying that that's obviously 100% true, but Fox News, I don't think I'm the only one who thinks that they are, you know, they basically are paid to lie. You know, they're paid to fabricate, they're paid to spin, and that's exactly what happens in this film. It kind of does cover all kind of all forms of what happens or what could happen in kind of different countries across the world. Obviously, you have maybe different levels of it in terms of the manipulation of media. You have like North Korea, which is blatantly lying to everyone, saying that, you know, at times they'll say Kim Jong-il has won the Olympics or something crazy like that. Like it's so nonsensical, but they do it anyway. Or you'll have Fox News say, actually, in fact, interestingly enough, you know, obviously we're recording now and they're in the middle of counting these votes for the US election still. And there was actually a story that broke that, this is kind of off skew a little bit, but a story broke that Fox News were the first to announce one of the states for Biden. And Trump was furious and called up Rupert Murdoch saying, you know, that's not your job. You should be supporting me. Why are you breaking news that the Democrats are winning a state? You should be supporting me. And that in itself is just messed up, that, you know, a government official, a leader of a country expects a news organization to completely back them 100%, no matter the facts. And that's kind of, I suppose it does lean into what is being portrayed in this film as well.
Yeah. I think that's something that, like all the kind of normal on the nose stuff, like we talked about, the reliance on symbols to make meaning, and, you know, blowing up Parliament, what that signifies, blowing up the justice system, what that signifies, is really interesting. But I love that you've touched on the whole, the idea of the media's manipulation and how the media and governments work. And I love this stuff. Like, I'm currently learning about this in uni as well. And seeing it in this film is really interesting because, like you said, it came out in 2005 based on a novel that came before that. And I don't know, to see this in, I wouldn't say a rudimentary or crude way, but in a very straightforward way. No bullshit, no nuance. It's just telling you that this is what's happening in this world. Take from that what you will. I really, really enjoyed that. And those scenes are actually some of the most playful ones, because even though they are quite heavy in subject matter, the one-liners or the kind of, I don't know, subtle little comedic moments, like you said, that line, the media aren't here to make or to something about truth. The government are here to lie about it, or I don't know what it was. I butchered that. But those little moments are the ones I really enjoyed from this. And I think that's that's what keeps you going. Like you could say this film is just about how it's kind of like a crusade against fascism and be done with it. But there's also so much more it makes comments on. And that's why I think it's really rewatchable. That's why I wanted to rewatch it instantly.
Because there's another quote I love as well. This one is more about, this is kind of dead on about basically what the film's about in terms of the people need their voice back. And it's when, I think it's Stephen Fry's character that says it. I'm not 100% sure though. But the character says, people should not be afraid of the government. The government should be afraid of the people. And that is the opposite of what it is in this world at the minute until V starts his vendetta against the government. I was going to ask you though, Connor, do you think his vendetta is more against the people that worked at the hospital and what happened to him rather than the government in itself? You know, would he, obviously what happened to him would fuel him regardless, obviously, because, you know, he's been burnt alive, he's been tortured, he's been injected with different things, and he's now got I think they mentioned at one point his reflexes are much faster, and he walks out of a fire, for God's sake, still alive. They've clearly done something to him and made him, you know, more than human. But I just wonder if his vendetta is more against the people that did that to him rather than the government that are ruling, you know, rightly or wrongly. So, you know, what's your take on that?
I find this really interesting because I think it does kind of sway from vendetta against government into just revenge for his cause. And I think that's something that Evie begins to have take umbrage with. And it kind of, that amongst other things, causes a strain on their relationship. For me, it's hard to talk about this without we've already established how relevant it is to where we are now at times. So I feel like my comments might suggest my own political beliefs, and I'm not trying to do that. But, you know, I was on his side. I still kind of was on his side. Do I think his methods were right? Not really.
I mean, when you look at the kind of people he killed, you know, a molesting priest.
Exactly. They go evil, evil, evil. Yeah.
To the point where it is, you know, I think they do it for a reason, don't they? Because obviously what he's doing is murdering people, which is so wrong, but he's murdering these people who are atrocious, vile people that, you know, don't really deserve to be living like a free life. Which I guess I'm certainly no way suggesting it's lazy writing, but it's certainly, you know, a kind of an escape route for them so that they can do these things, you know, and still have support for V, and you still want him to succeed in the end, despite the fact that he's, you know, a murderer.
Well, that's one of my favorite discussion points from this film is the idea of they call him a freedom fighter at times. The media could purvey him as a terrorist.
Yeah.
That discussion point is far more nuanced than a conversation that we're probably ready to have now or even the next 5 years or even over a beer, probably. Especially not on a podcast. But that as a conversation in general is quite an interesting one, and one that requires much, you know, a lot of reading and a lot of nuance and is applicable is relative to many different conversations. But that's something I really enjoyed in there, because he clearly is fighting for what he believes in and what he thinks will uplift the people. But who is he to say that his word is gospel? And I like that he has this kind of moment where he says, like, I've made my choices for what I'm doing. I'm leaving this choice up to the next generation or the next line of people. And then you go, oh, okay, all right. It is almost altruism, almost.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's where you almost gain respect for him. You know, it's him saying, you know, this isn't my future, this is your future. You know, if only people had have voted that way for Brexit, maybe we'd be in a much better way right now. God. But hey, this is a political film. We can get political sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. Maybe if more people were like, more older people were like V, we'd be in a much better better place right now.
This is very interesting. I feel like between this particular week on the podcast and my two modules in uni at the minute, one is I'm talking about Shane Meadows and Thatcherist Britain, wow. And the other one I'm talking about, I don't know, fucking communism and Stalinism in Russia. Yeah. Oh my God, propaganda everywhere. I can't handle it.
I know. What I want to quickly just do is rattle off a few actual plot points, because although we have dug into the film, we've not really gone through some of the actual key points of the film. It's not actually, you know, in a sense, you can go through it pretty quickly. Basically, after V and Evie meet at the start, they go their separate ways, but then they meet again as he breaks into a newsroom and tries to... Well, he does. He broadcasts a kind of, what is it, like a little short clip saying what he wants to do and what he plans on doing the following year on bonfire night. Then she gets knocked unconscious as he's trying to escape. And then he takes her to his lair, this underground gaff. Looks very cozy. He's got a jukebox with 800 odd songs on. Lovely.
They're good songs. Well, the two songs they had the rights to are pretty good in this film. Yeah,
cracking. And this is where she kind of, you know, it's that whole thing where they get to spend some quality time together. You know, she begins to kind of gain some sort of affection for him. He starts to, I guess, fall in love with her in a sense. I'm sure he says to her at the end that he loves her, something like that. Does he, or have I just imagined that? I'm sure he says he loves her at the end.
There's something very similar. If he doesn't say it in words, he says it with actions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she kisses him on his mask. You know, that's... Yeah, that,
hated
that's
that.
I know she can't. But, you know,
it's 2020. Exactly, we've all had a kiss with a mask on. Yeah.
Exactly. V is, you know, V, wear the mask, man. It's 2020. You've got to wear your mask. That's what I'm going to take now. Next time I go for my weekly shop, I'm going to put my Guy Fawkes mask on.
Yeah, please don't.
Why not? Anyway, I've completely lost my train of thought. Where was I going with this? Basically, yeah, it's running through what happens. Then it kind of goes straight to the point where he goes to the pedophile priest. And it's like it's so gross because she dresses up as like a young girl almost. And he's saying, the guy explains to the priest that she's not as young as they usually are. It's so kind of vomit inducing. And then she tries to tell him what's actually happening. And she's saying, oh, please, can you help me? And he just thinks it's a part of some weird like sex game. And like then essentially like jumps on top of her, then luckily V comes in. But then it's kind of at that point that she escapes to Stephen Fry. And then he captures her again. I know it's kind of like she gets captured by him almost, because he says that she's got to stay there for a whole entire year until the next bonfire. But I think it's the moment that he gets her for the second time is the most interesting, because it's, you don't know that she is with him. She's basically captured, put in a cell. She has her head shaved. She's tortured. She's basically broken down to the point of she doesn't want to live anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think the final question she's asked is, I'm sending you to the firing squad. All you have to do to save your life is tell me any information about V. And she doesn't. And that's like her test. She's passed. But what were your opinions on that? Because it turns out, obviously, that V is the guy that's, you know, this girl who saved his life. You know, she's maybe like, you know, she's kind of put her trust in him. She's helped him at times. And now he's captured her, beaten her up, shaved her head, you know, locked her in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? You know, how are we still meant to think this guy's like the hero of the film?
It's once again, it's really, really hard to not put a 2020 look at this with my 2020 lenses on.
Mm.
But it's almost radicalization. It really, for me, it was anyway. I was looking at this and I didn't see it coming, first of all. Obviously, this is my first take.
I forgot that happened.
Completely caught me off guard. And I was like, what? I kept thinking that it would be her dad. Genuinely. And I thought it was going to be that fucking awful mask reveal. Oh my God, it's her dad. Or oh my God, it's actually Guy Fawkes from 1407. And thankfully, it was neither of those things. But I hated that bit, you know. I don't really understand it. I don't really understand the message it's trying to say. You know what I mean? Normally the scene like that, it comes with undertones of, I don't know, normally you have to be broken down to be built back up. But what she's built into is someone who's just subservient to his cause. And yeah. if we've talked about, you think his vendetta is actually more revenge rather than altruistic intentions, then it's radicalization for me personally. Yeah.
And I think what's messed up about the whole thing is he does that to her, but then, you know, at the end of the film, he has thousands and thousands. He sends, I think it's like ballpark, like in its 700 odd thousands of masks to all these British citizens. And it's basically saying, come and see on the 5th of November, put your mask on, come and support me when I blow up Parliament on the 5th of November. And, you know, there are thousands of people that go. So, and they've not been radicalized in a sense that they've been locked up or whatever.
Yeah.
They've been, I don't know if it's a form of radicalization. It's more of a form of rebellion because they've been downtrodden and treated like shit by their current government to the point where, as V says, blowing up Parliament symbolizes change. More than anything, it's a change that needs to happen.
Here's something I find interesting is that in that moment when it's revealed that she's free at the end of it, when she doesn't turn given any evidence towards or about V, I think the last line that is said to her before the reveal is that then you have no fear anymore, and maybe that's his point, is to make her fearless. And if that's the case, you know, watch Hereditary once, bro. It's 2028. Watch it once. Nothing else can scare you like it scared me. All right. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Anyway, maybe that's what they're doing. It kind of missed me a little bit. That's a bit of a downside for the film.
I think it really does. That's where it really does push the boundaries on what's good and what isn't when you're trying to be the hero of the film. Mm-hmm. You know, kill pedophilic priests by all means, because, you know, they've got it coming to them. But, you know, locking up an innocent, you know, young girl who has lost her mum, her dad, and her baby brother, you know, it almost makes you think, is this really the right thing to be doing?
You Another know? Thing I've just thought about, maybe this is me just trying to give it, you know, the benefit of the doubt, is that maybe it took someone to be completely broken down and completely, you know, have no sides. Maybe that made her not kind of identify that much with his manifesto because it was experienced on her. She already knows what the other side's like, so she's completely neutral. And in that moment, she's the one to decide. So ultimately, she's doing it for altruistic gain. Maybe.
And she does leave as well, I suppose. She does leave. She says she's leaving and he doesn't stop her afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that was all part of the master plan. Who knows? If that's the way it was meant to be done, fair enough.
Yeah.
But it took me a while to figure that one out.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, that even a film like this, it's a DC film in a way, very much political undertones, but there's still very much a lot to be, that is open for interpretation, which is great. I think that's what we want. You know, that's why it's great to talk about films. That's why I think all films, well, most films, I guess, need to be discussed. You know, I'm not saying let's have a sit down and talk for an hour about Adam Sandler's new film, Hubie Halloween. but films like this that almost demand a discussion, especially something that is, you know, a conversation me and you would have had about that film 15 years ago when it came out. Would have been completely different to us now. I'm not at the ages.
Not at eight. The age of eight, because
I'm saying, because we
the masks were good. The bit when he threw the knives was good.
yeah, 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 I mean, if we were 20 years old watching the film for the first time in 2005 when the world was in a completely different place, mm-hmm. we probably would have had a lot of different things to say. Probably more leaning towards the maybe like the Iraq war and stuff like that, kind of, because the obviously you have, there are mentions in the film, aren't there, of how they're that one of the real bad guys had been kind of he'd been in all the different, like, Iraq, Afghanistan, yeah. and stuff like that.
He was a general.
He was a general in and then all of a sudden he's like, oh, here's something. Sorry, just I've completely forgot. We haven't spoke about John Hurt, who is
he's amazing. Who is
the leader of I love John Hurt. Sorry, yeah. God rest his soul. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's basically the tyrannical leader, I guess. And you get these shots which are almost solely inspired by, you know, like the shots you see of like Hitler in front of his Nazi boys, you know, back in when you know, the late 1930s, when he was kind of rallying them up for his fucking bullshit. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of taken straight from that, in that he's there kind of dressed kind of very he's dressed all in black, isn't he, and he's got all these followers with their flags, and it all looks very kind of evil. It just is evil. I think that's where, like, I was thinking, I think we don't talk enough about the costume design, really, but the costume
this
design
is a really good
great.
Show. I actually really agree with you on this.
I wrote her name down, Sammy Sheldon, who's actually worked on some comic book films before. She's worked on Ant-Man. She did Ex Machina as well, which is obviously I'm sure she must have been heavily involved in the robotic design in that film.
So she's
a good one, because to come up, I think, with this is completely, I've just gone off here from what I was talking about, but to come up with something so famous like that mask and the kind of outfit, you know, it's a good one when it becomes a Halloween costume. Do you know,
and it
what
becomes
I mean?
Iconic or as when, well, yeah.
And it becomes iconic in that, you know, there's a hacktivist group that use the mask and with the wig, and they're all about kind of almost showing the bad sides of political reigns and different governments and stuff, and what they do wrong. And I don't know if they're even about now. I think there are some people say that they are kind of knocking about, but it's probably just people saying that they are. But in their heyday, they were, what were they doing? They were breaking all sorts of things, like Russian involvement in like elections and stuff like that.
Yeah. They were honestly like a big, 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 I don't know how to word this, a big force during like the 2010s as well. Like, it was a scary time to be a bad guy in that, frankly. Here's a quick thing, right? Normally we talk about like individual scenes or bits you loved the most. Was there anything that really stuck out for you? Obviously this wasn't your first take, it was mine, but you said it was almost like a refresh of what the film was actually about. A favorite moment, or maybe a moment that kind of encapsulates the film in a whole, or just whatever you want to talk about.
I think the moment that probably encapsulates the film, in a sense, not in terms of the grand scale of the end, but in terms of getting a grasp on who the characters truly are and what they are going to become or what they're going to do, is the moment where V lets Evie out of her cell. She kind of has this really brilliant acting. I know we mentioned right at the start of the pod about her terrible English accent, which it is bad, but nonetheless, she's still a cracking actress. So when it comes to the emotive scenes, you know, she's spot on, and she kind of like falls to the floor just as she's kind of in shock, and she has like a little panic attack, and it's really like she's can't breathe. And as she's doing it, I'm like, Jesus, it's like so realistic. Anyway, just following that moment, she walks outside into the rain, and it's kind of it's cut side by side with V walking out of the fire of the hospital. Mm-hmm. Like, he's walking out of the fire and she's walking out in the rain, and they're both holding their hands up in a V, You know, looking up to the
I didn't
sky.
even clock that. Oh yeah. What type of film fucking student am I? Jesus. Yeah, the V thing. Didn't get it. Go on.
Like, it's so, it's just, it's, it encapsulates also, it's not to get too kind of like philosophical, but it's like the yin and yang. Like, he comes out of fire and she's kind of going into like the water, the rain. And it, this is one where I quite like the editing. I know it is maybe a bit too on the nose in terms of cutting back in two, but this film was actually edited by Martin Welsh, who edited Wonder Woman, which we didn't like his editing on that, but he did win an Oscar for Chicago, which we said last time as well. Yeah. But yeah, I think props to him on this, in this scene. I think I think obviously it is quite on the nose, but I think it warrants that, that cut. He does do it twice, which is a bit annoying, but
this is the I fully agree with you, but you need it once is enough.
Once is enough
for me, but yeah. It's awesome. I love that scene. I love
it. But yeah, it's brilliant. It, cause it just encapsulates the characters. It encapsulates what she is now become, you know, this kind of free spirit who is like V, but also kind of the opposite.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is, and that is just all in, you know, no dialogue. That's all in the visuals. And that's kind of where the director, James McTague, who we haven't really mentioned, but I don't think he's not done any other films that I know of anyway, but I think he has done quite a good job with this film, you know, with the direction of his actors. And, you know, there are moments that are really brilliant. I think it's let down a little bit with some ever so slightly tacky elements, I would say.
I think it's not dated, but in terms of its acting and its writing, it is. And maybe we feel that way because if it was made nowadays the exact same way with the exact same actors in the exact same time with a bit of a better budget, you know.
I think it's like also kind of it's the Wachowski style though, isn't it? It is a little bit, you know, The Matrix, it's dead famous film, but you have to say at times the writing is a bit rigid.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, despite, you know, the awesomeness of it and, you know, the way they write kind of, you know, the
spectacles. They write very visually, I fully agree with you.
I was just basically agreeing with you. They do write visually, which is very apparent. I think the Adrian Biddle, who's a cinematographer on this film, he actually worked on Aliens, which is like...
Really?
Yeah. That's so awesome, which is mental. Just really spot on work. But yeah, a little bit rigid at times. And I think that might just be their style. You know, they're all about more of the feeling than the specificity of, you know, dialogue. Mm-hmm. Dialogue is usually very important, but for some reason with their films, it's not.
I always feel like the dialogue is the least nuanced part of their films.
Yeah.
It's to get from A to B. There's not really any like alternate meanings there, but they do that through their visual writing.
Yeah, definitely.
My favorite, there's a couple of examples for that, but I think you've summed it up properly. If we're going to talk about my favorite moment, I couldn't get over how just how cool this film is, and the kind of like heist that happens when V breaks into the BTN network, which is the British television network, obviously, you know, a doppelganger for the BBC in this case. And it's kind of like, it's almost shot like a heist film. His plans are always executed perfectly. And as a rewatcher of Ocean's 11, at least six times a year, I'm all about that. And I just loved that scene. I thought it was so cool. I kind of like that you have the element of V being totally in control, but right at the end, he isn't. And the person that bails him out is Evie.
Yeah,
and then that's kind of another basis on their relationship, and it parallels their first meeting. And I just loved it. I loved it so much. And his kind of broadcast on national news and in not Times Square, whatever, Trafalgar Square, whatever it is in London, it's awesome. I loved it.
So why don't we end by just talking about the culmination of the film? He finally gets what he's been planning on for years. The Parliament blows up. What did we make of that?
Once again, just talking about the film, just talking about the, you know, the
Apart from
symbolic
Unbridled Joy,
meaning.
Connor, you bastard.
No, genuinely, I thought it was really cool. I didn't really love the music choice, but it echoed earlier moments in
Yeah.
the film, so fair enough, it works. But I really loved that it kind of ends as a symbol of hope, even though this guy, who I have a lot of issues with and his methods, it was ultimately Evie's decision at the end to go
Yeah.
through with it. And
And I
because
love.
we all back her, you're rooting for her, you're rooting for her decisions, and then ultimately you agree with them. And it
Yeah.
is kind of like, it is the moment of hope, and they do this really good thing that I'm probably sure you're going to talk about, and I don't want to ruin it for you. Is it the moment where they have this discussion of you can't kill an
Yeah.
idea, and ideas and people with the idea is, you know, the people that keep believing in it, and if they die about it, the idea lives on in their memory. And it cuts to the people that have earlier on died in the film are in the crowd
Yeah.
currently.
Yeah.
Fuck me, that's good. That's really good. And
Yeah.
I wasn't in a cinema, but if I was, I would have done my little tiny clap.
And it's kind of the moment as well, right at the end, where Evie is asked about him and their relationship, and she says, "He's my father and my mother and my brother." And that is kind of, that's when you realize that he's almost like a god figure,
He's an
you know.
idea.
He's like,
A
he's
deity
an,
almost,
yeah, a deity, you know. That is, maybe that is what he ultimately wanted in the end, you know. That was his ultimate plan for change. He speaks, you know, obviously the first thing you see him do is blow up the Old Bailey, and then he talks about, Jesus, did you hear that firework?
I did actually.
Sorry.
I thought
Oh
you just
my.
were shot there.
It's
We're
very
recording on
apt.
bonfire night, and it probably isn't the best time. We should have done this at maybe like 2 o'clock in the day, but we were both busy. So, you know,
Yeah.
it is what it is. A little bit of bass in your
Hey, it
headphones.
adds to it. Just as we're talking about the explosion of Parliament, a massive firework goes off right by my house. Hopefully that's it. Hopefully they only had money for two fireworks and they shut up. Yeah, so I love the ending. I thought it was brilliant. I'm glad it just ended like that with the I'm glad they didn't kind of go into like 2 weeks later and Evie's dead happy because, you know, she's
She's the new president or whatever the fuck it is, the
yeah.
High Chancellor of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Basically, I think this film's great. And it's another one, I'm pretty sure we say this every week, or I say this every week. The more I speak about this film, the more I love it. And this very much actually feels like a first take for me because I've not watched it in so long. I think I remember, this is so strange, watching it with my dad about probably, it was probably about 13, maybe even 14 years ago. We used to rent DVDs from the news agents on a Saturday night with a takeaway. And I'm pretty sure on this one occasion, I had earlier that day split my eyelid open at a water park, went down a slide and jumped off the little rubber dinghy for some reason. And it came down at the behind me and smashed my head into the side. And I had all blood dripping down my face. And
Here's a
my eye was
question.
out like that.
I love that you
Yeah.
can remember. You always have these things where you can remember details about when you watch films. Do you remember what
Yeah,
you
I know.
had from the takeaway that night? Or what was the
No,
go-to
but
takeaway on Saturday nights?
it was often you know, just like a straight up boring chicken kebab. I do th th this is dead strange. I remember watching renting the film Shanghai Noon, Jackie Chan and Owen Wilson. I remember renting
Love that film.
Shanghai Noon. I must have been about 8 years old, maybe. Now, I was probably, maybe, I don't know actually. God, it still blends into one. Anyway, I remember sitting down. I used to have this Lego table that I used to eat my dinner at. I used to have it in this room, but I took it into the living room. I was sat in front of the telly with my Lego table, with my chicken kebab and chips on my plate, watching Shanghai Noon with my dad, with this DVD, with this rent from the news agents. I could probably, if I thought about it, tell you about 20 to 30 films that we rented from the news agents when I was a kid, like over 15 years ago. Because I'm just weird like that.
Anyway, sorry, we went on a tangent there, but I just had to know.
Yeah.
So this was almost a first take for you. So I'll give my popcorn second. What would you rate this film?
So my popcorns are, see, I feel like this is the most in-depth we've spoke about a film in a while.
It is, you know, it really feels like it is.
I feel like it has warranted it, though. I'm going to go for 77 popcorns.
That's so strange. I've just written down the exact same thing. Sorry to cut the reveal, but I've literally just circled it and you said 77. Sorry, yeah.
Isn't that so strange? We're just on the same level, bro. 77 popcorns. I was probably more at like the 70, and then we spoke about it a lot, and then I was like, I really like this film way more than I thought I did, and I was like, do I go for 80? And I was like, no, I'm gonna go for a modest 77. Which I think is great for a film that has quite a lot of elements that I didn't like, but ultimately its themes and quite a lot of its imagery won me over because it's just brilliant. And you know, the character of V looks great and is interesting enough to, you know, have, you know, long discussions about like we have just. What are your popcorns then?
Mate, honestly, well, 77, but I echo everything you've just said. And I love talking about V just quickly. He holds up. Like, we all know him as this iconic figure, but I
bet if you did. Oh, Hugo Weaving, by the way.
I know.
You should mention.
I know. Cool
I
guy.
I forget because, yeah, I love Hugo Weaving. Watched a film of his, like an Australian film that he was in maybe like 30 years ago called The Interview. It's on Netflix, set solely in a interrogation room. It's really good.
Oh, I've heard about this. Yeah,
it's really good. Anyway, yeah, that's just another Hugo Weaving film that he's bossing. But yeah, I think it's just really interesting. Obviously, as well, he's an Aussie, but his English accent's brilliant. So yeah. Props to him.
Good on you, Hugo, friend of the show, Hugo Weaving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, the film's awesome. He holds up as a character. He's interesting. Evie's awesome. Natalie Portman, honestly, for me, steals the whole film. V might be super cool, but her performance is ridiculously good.
But every time John Hurt is on that big screen yelling at people, he also steals the scene.
True.
John Hurt is just a little legend. Well, that's a really bad thing. That was a Freudian slip. I said he's a living legend.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, sick film. If you've got this far and we've spoiled it for you, please go and check it out. It's completely worth your time. And it isn't as doom and gloom as we might have conveyed.
No, but it'll make you think, it will definitely make you think what is going on in the world right now. Which I think some critical thinking is important, especially when things are going to shit.
Yeah, as you so eloquently put. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So, merry bonfire night. Before I say goodbye, actually, let's talk about next week's film.
Oh my god, I'm so excited.
Where we are covering Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
The Coen brothers' Fargo. I have never seen this film before. Connor, you've never seen this film before.
No, it's me that has saw it.
Okay. I've never seen this film before. You have seen this film before. Luke's never seen this film before. Hopefully Luke will be back next week. I'm very much excited about this film. For some reason I haven't watched the film, but I've watched like the first three series of the TV show. I think the first series of the TV show is meant to be quite similar to the film.
Yeah, it's linked. Yeah, it's linked. Yeah.
Anywho, super pumped for that because I've not really watched many Coen Brothers films. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Connor?
I just want to say that I think this is one that I've been pushing for a while. And normally when there's like a big film that you and Luke both haven't saw that we're both going to cover on the podcast, it normally is one of the best ones. You know what I mean? Like, I remember you guys both hadn't watched No Country for Old Men. We all three of us loved that. There'll Be Blood as well was another first take for both of you guys. And we all loved that as well. So hopefully we get another good... Yeah. Honest, solid Oscar-winning film and Oscar-winning podcast. Hopefully someday.
Yeah. Oh wow, yeah. Well, I know that I know this is a lot of film journalists that I like. I know that this is their favorite Coen film.
Yeah, it's elite. It's one of like
my mum loves that film as well, and she doesn't watch a lot of Coen Brothers films.
I will just say as well. Hopefully, as well as that, there might be another little special podcast that me and you are going to be putting out next week or maybe the week after. We're chatting to a couple of local filmmakers. I know Thomas is definitely coming on. I'm not sure about the actual director of the film. Yeah, so basically two guys that I've been in touch with are crowdfunding a film during coronavirus, and they're doing really, really well. They've got some cool producers on board. Everything's written, everything's ready to go. They're just waiting for lockdown to eventually end and everything to be safe. And yeah, you'll hopefully hear more about that next week as well.
Yeah, awesome. So on that note, let's leave it there. We'll see you next week. Thank you, guys. See ya.